It's blazing hot outside. You get in your car to turn on the AC to get cold air pumping, but it blows hot air out. This issue is commonly caused by low refrigerant due to leaks in the AC system. You want an easy, all-in-one solution that will restore the cold air in no time. AC Pro Recharge Kits make restoring cold air easy for even those with zero DIY experience in less than 10 minutes. Save time and money versus going to a shop by picking up an AC Pro Recharge Kit today. Be a pro with AC Pro.
Before we open this week's episode of the Show Before the Show podcast, I have to ask Sam Dykstra, who's on your shirt? Is that Bruce?
I did not plan this out. Sam's going to be wearing a band t-shirt every week. This is just how my wardrobe works out right now. It is Bruce. It is Bruce Springsteen for the Born in the USA tour, which last time I wore this in the office, I had people coming up to me and being like, how old are you again? Like, this is not from that
sports
tour.
Writer. You have to be a sports
writer. I'm just a sports writer.
I was going to say, breaking news, baseball writer loves Bruce Springsteen.
Baseball writer from the East Coast loves Bruce Springsteen.
No. Yeah. No, I got this at his tour last year in New Jersey.
Were you born when that picture was taken? You were like a decade away from being born when that picture was taken, I think, right?
I'm trying to remember when this tour was. I was not born.
Let me look at the back of your shirt, Sam. This was the 84-85 tour.
Okay, there we go.
Even I wasn't born. Wow. Okay. Yeah. Well, I feel
there were
a lot
of dates on this tour, U.S. and Europe. Looking at some minor league towns. He played in Greensboro.
Okay.
Played in Lexington. He played in Indianapolis, Louisville, Columbia, Charlotte, Syracuse.
Wow.
Heck yeah. He got on the road.
Fan of minor league baseball, Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah,
I have no idea if we can confirm that. Bruce, come on the show.
Yeah, come on the show, Bruce.
Your love of minor league.
Yeah, one of those venues was a minor league ballpark, actually. Little known fact about that tour is he played at minor league ballparks throughout.
This has not been confirmed yet, but let's go with it.
Do you remember, guys, what was it, like at this point, better part of 15 years ago, when Willie Nelson and Bob Dylan did a minor league ballpark centric tour?
I do remember that.
And at the time, I was kind of lukewarm on both those guys. And now I'm like, why didn't I go to that? Like, I've since then loved seeing those guys live separately. And God bless them. They're still out there at age 90 and 82, respectively, I believe.
Hopefully,
and Bruce, God willing, will be as well. We'll see.
Yeah, sure. What was that? Hey, welcome into the latest episode of the Show Before the Show podcast, the official podcast of minor league baseball. Those two dudes are Benjamin Hill and Sam Dykstra. My name is Tyler Mon, and we welcome you in wherever you found us. Thanks for hanging out with us on this week's episode of the Show Before the Show. You can get in touch with us, of course, podcast@milb.com. Spring training games underway. Prospects starting to get into spring action. Of course, spring breakout rosters coming up next week. We got all kinds of fun stuff to talk about. And thanks for hanging out with us on this week's episode. It is not often that we kick off an episode with a discussion of a new team identity from a league that, to be frank, none of us had ever heard of. But there is a jumping the shark kind of logo that came out this week for a team in a collegiate summer league known as the Old North State League. And it took the baseball internet by storm of sorts yesterday. Dudes from the creative brains behind the Danville Otterbots, a team in the Appalachian League, formerly an affiliated league and now a partner league with MLB. There is a new baseball team on the baseball landscape in the Old North State League known as the, quote, Danville Dairy Daddies, which I am uncomfortable just saying. It features the logo is like a hunky anthropomorphic cow who's standing upright on two legs, wearing jeans but no shirt, leaning on a bat, and a very sultry face for this cow. There is a lot to unpack. Ben, what do we know about the Danville Dairy Daddies? A Studio Simon creation, by the way.
Well, I hadn't even looked it up that much. They play at the same ballpark as the Danville Otterbots, who were the Danville Braves for many years when the Appy League used to be affiliated. I was able to visit that ballpark twice through the years. It's a very Appy League, small, intimate. It's within a large, much larger kind of public park system that's called Dan Daniel Park. So it's like the Daniel Braves or Danville's baseball taking place at Dan Daniel Park. And at times the ballpark had been called Dan Daniel Field, I believe. So there's a lot of Dan. I remember
Dan Simon as well.
Yeah, Dan Simon, yeah. I remember when I visited there in 2016, like a popular meme at the time was that Damn Daniel, you know, wearing the white, the kid like wearing the white van. Yeah, so I was trying to do like Vine jokes based on Dan Daniel. Anyway, it was a long time ago. But I have a sense, and I haven't looked into this, but Austin Scher, I believe that's how you say his last name, S-C-H-E-R. I should know. I've known the guy for a long time. He was with the Daytona Tortugas for a while, went to the Appy League, rebranded, you know, the Danville Braves once that league went summer collegiate as the Otterbots, which is a pretty unique name. So I think he has something to do with kind of being on the forefront of pushing the envelope with team names. So the Otterbots will now be sharing the field with the Dairy Daddies. It is designed to provoke, I believe, get a reaction. There is a sex appeal, would we say, to this cow? I don't know. The internet loved it. I mean, he's shirtless and he's got a belt buckle that says DD. Yeah, sultry is a good word, Tyler. And they're the Dairy Daddies, and they got merch already that says like get milked and all this kind of stuff. So
should we also mention the sizes of the shirts? The shirts come in your regular small, medium, large, extra large, but the way that they've designated the sizes on the website are skim, 1%, 2%, whole, creamy, and I think extra creamy.
Yeah, yeah.
The
cow's name, by the way, is McCreamy.
Yeah, McCreamy. And they play on a field of creams. Oh, that's what they're calling their playing field.
Boy, oh boy. Things that I'm not sure you could get away with if you were an affiliated league. I also
not sure.
Has to be a Grey's Anatomy nod, right? I've never even watched that show, but remember when that was like so in the zeitgeist, like nothing could go through a prism of anything pop culture without being related to Grey's Anatomy for like 5 minutes in the mid 2000s. And is that show apparently it's still on TV? That show's been on TV.
It is still on TV.
1990.
It's just a soap opera that happens at night. That's what I've decided about Grey's Anatomy. But yeah, McSteamy, McDreamy, now there's a McCreamy. I mean, all good things coming
through. Which we were all waiting for. The other shoe finally dropped. We were all waiting for it. According to our good friend Paul Caputo, who wrote a profile of this identity for our other good friend Chris Creamer's website, sportslogos.net, he talked to Dan Simon from Studio Simon. And Dan said that, and this is actually my favorite element of this. He said when he was creating the logo, the person that he had in mind was Joey Tribbiani from Friends. Pretty funny. That's pretty great. And it does definitely look like the face and the line that this cow would give you. How you doing?
That does feel like such an episode of Friends, right? Like all of a sudden Joey gets a gig.
As a minor league baseball mascot.
Yeah.
He has to play a cow that has a six pack for some reason.
Yeah, and Paul Caputo, friend of the show, he was bragging on Twitter about the headline for this article because he set his personal alliteration record with septuple alliteration. Danville does double duty. Dairy Daddy's debut. Impressive. Septuple alliteration. And I was like, I've done that before. I'm so good at that kind of thing. And then I couldn't remember an example where I got up to seven.
I just don't think we have enough space in a headline on MILB.com for you to get seven alliterative words into a headline. Maybe that's a challenge moving forward.
It is.
I explain my only my big gripe with the Dairy Daddy's name? Aside from the fact that, like, as a broadcaster, if I had to call a team the Daddies the entire, I would be so uncomfortable. But male cows don't make milk.
Tyler, you're a little bit behind the times.
I just, you know, like the whole thing, like all the milk puns and everything. Like, shouldn't this be a heifer? Aren't heifers the ones? Although in Rocco's Modern Life, the character named Heifer was a boy, so that was odd. I'm a little like, I don't know. There's a lot going on here with the Danville Dairy. They certainly, I mean, I was getting texts from people who I don't talk baseball with who were sending me this the link to this identity and this story and all that. So they hit it out of the park with that.
Yeah, I mean, they've certainly captured the attention of everybody. And, you know, as we were kind of talking off air before, I'm a little worried about what the next step beyond Dairy Daddies is. This kind of feels like we've hit as far as this could possibly go. And yet in this business, everybody's one-upping everybody all the time. So
yeah. When it came out, I did text you two and Josh Jackson and say, all right, we have more than jumped the shark now. Like, there have been a lot of shark jumping names. It actually kind of surprises me that a team has not done an alternate identity night called like the Shark Jumpers.
I used to say that on Twitter and in my blog years ago all the time. I thought it was inevitable, but I don't recall that ever happening, because it seemed like, I think, you know, we're in the affiliated world, you know, it's gotten a little more conservative, and it was kind of pushed as far as it could go anyway. I think once we got the Trash Pandas, I think we're seeing maybe that moment have peaked in the affiliated world. But, you know, in Summer Collegiate, we're showing there's brave new territory to still explore and open up. And, you know, when I tweeted about this yesterday, you know, starting with like NFSW or NSFW, maybe, you know, maybe? Not safe for work. I'm like, this is kind of erotic looking, but I tweeted it, and the first reply on the tweet was Samuel Goldberg saying, like, I'm the broadcaster and I'm excited for this. He is also the broadcaster for the Danville Otterbots, so he'll be doing all the games for both teams, and he's psyched to be like, and that ball is out of here, yes daddy. Or whatever the catchphrase may be.
I'm leaving that.
Oh, no.
I'm leaving that alone. I'm leaving
so alone. Many people just got their new alarm in the morning.
That's going to be, can you still set custom ringtones? Like the way you used to be able to? I just think the Shark Jumpers identity, Happy Days, which is what Jumping the Shark is based on, a scene from Happy Days in which Fonzie literally jumped a shark, correct? I believe.
Correct.
I think that's where the team came from. The term that is. So, you know, for like the Wisconsin Timber Rattlers, you're the closest squad. This is on you. You have to be the Shark Jumpers at some point. The whole industry is looking to Wisconsin. You're the closest team to Milwaukee where the show is set. It's got to happen.
Yeah, and you could just have a lot of fun with it. You could have the mascot, like, jump a shark, you know, on a bike off a little plywood ramp over a stuffed shark. You know, there's so many things you could do.
Plus, we know, you know, what the Timber Rattlers mascot has its own evil alternate identity.
Naff.
And Naff. So, like, one of those two could do it. Well, we had to get the Danville Dairy Daddies conversation out of the way because, you know, it's February 29th. It's Leap Day.
Anything goes
on Leap Day. This is a conversation we can have today and then package up and not revisit again until 2028. That's how this works.
Yeah. Ooh. Happy Leap Day, everybody, even though you'll be hearing this in March, but we're recording on Leap Day. It's special. This is the first ever episode of the podcast to be recorded on Leap Day, I believe. We'll have to go back in our records and confirm that. I also snuck a fact past Sam today that he didn't know, but not every 4 years is a leap day. There are leap day skip years, and the next one is in 2100. So set your calendars for
that.
What? Yeah, because the average length of a calendar year is not exactly 365.25. It's like slightly less than that. So to keep it like up to speed, there are occasional, very rare leap day skip years.
Dead. By 2100, I won't even have to worry about it.
Sam said he's going to be alive.
Hey, I'm going to. You probably 110? Could. I can make it to 110.
Yeah, you can make it to 110. Yeah. They say that like the first human being to live to 150 has already been born.
Yeah.
Although the way
I'm
the world
right here, Tyler.
Probably
no.
Not.
Tyler will, or Sam will still be doing this podcast with our cremated remains on each side of him.
Our cremated remains.
Yeah.
Am I right?
That's right, Dairy Daddy.
Am I right?
Right. And Dairy Daddy logo urns.
They just dunk them into a big, it's just a milk bottle. That's the urn. Oh, Lord. Now that we've discussed the fact that it is actually Leap Day, I want to know if you dudes can name any ball players born on February 29th. Any big leaguers born on February 29th. Anybody?
I couldn't.
Off top of my head, that seems like a fact I would know because I used to be obsessed with players' birthdays as a kid, but no. I
there's really only like one from the, you know, the era that people who listen to this podcast would probably remember pretty well. Terrence Long. Remember Terrence Long?
Oh, yeah.
Outfielder Terrence Long was, which also Terrence Long, over the course of his career, played for five different teams. I vaguely remember him with the Royals, but Terrence Long also apparently played 12 games with the Yankees, three with the Mets, and 136 with the Padres. I do not remember his 04 season with the Padres. I just remember him as a as an A. But also, the leading WAR among anyone born on Leap Day, Al Rosen, who was born in 1924, and February 29th, 1924. He played.
Wow, happy 100th birthday, Al Rosen, or 25th in leap years.
He only passed away in 2015. He was around for 91 years. But he accumulated 32.3 WAR over the course of his career from 1947 to 1956 with the Cleveland Indians, as they were known at the time, of course. And he actually won the American League MVP back in 1953. So happy 100th birthday, Al Rosen, the leading WAR guy among anyone born on February 29th. Pepper Martin, also 22 WAR. He's the only other one with double-digit WAR. Pepper Martin, born 1904. Happy 120th birthday to Pepper Martin, who Sam Dykstra is going to outlive someday.
Yeah.
All right, dudes, let's pivot. We've got another alternate identity to discuss. This one a little bit tamer. Won't make you quite as hot under the collar. Winston-Salem, North Carolina, Benjamin Hill.
Yeah, Winston-Salem, who in recent years, Winston-Salem Dash, of course, in recent years have really upped their game promotionally and with food items at the ballpark. I think they'd always been a more conservative organization, but in the last couple of years, under their general manager, Brian DeAngelis, really gotten into the alternate identity game. Last year, if you recall, they did the hyphens, you know, finally, and we talked about that on the show, but finally,
I felt like that was a tribute to me because I always called them the Winston-Salem Dash on the air, and it annoyed everybody in that front office. But anyway.
Yeah, I think they had been harassed for years by the likes of Tyler Maughan about the fact that the dash in the team name is actually hyphen. So they did a hyphen one. They did the flights last year, a simultaneous tribute to craft beer in the region, you know, beer flights and the region's aviation history. Tyler, for those video subscribers to the podcast, is holding up the hyphen hat right now. And I like it. It's bracketed by parentheses too. Yeah. So it's
I should have bought one of these for my World Baseball Classic color analyst, Ryan Roland Smith, who was the first man in Major League history to have a hyphenated last name on his jersey. I should have bought him one. Maybe I'll just send him this one.
Yeah, that, I think you – yeah, that would be such a thoughtful gift. Anyway, they're still staying with the alternate identities. They have three scheduled for 2024 and more in 2025, I've been told. But the first one to be rolled out was earlier this week, the Tobacco Beetles. So you hear that, and first of all, you're like, tobacco? We don't promote anything smoking-related. But hey, maybe they were secretly the good guys because tobacco beetles were pests, you know, that tried to destroy the tobacco. It's not positioned that way, like, oh, we love those guys. They tried to keep us from stop smoking. You know, they were serious pests. They, you know, did their darndest to decimate the tobacco industry. Of course, Winston-Salem in North Carolina was an epicenter of the tobacco industry, especially about 100 years ago. So the branding, the tobacco beetle in question is very Natalie attired and driving a Model T Ford. He's got this kind of 1920s gangster kind of look. And so it's a tribute to the history of the region. They are doing some things in the present day based on, you know, crop health and, you know, still the need to fight against pests such as the tobacco beetles. But I think because tobacco is not as big a part of the economy the way it used to be back then, and that there are better, you know, control and extermination methods, they can, you know, people aren't saying too soon when it comes to the tobacco beetles, like, these guys destroyed my livelihood. What are you doing? You know, celebrating them on a ballpark. It's just a tribute to the history. And as, oh yeah, we've got the whole interview with Brian DeAngelis coming up. Yeah. I just get into talking about it. So, hey, we should, before I even go further, we're just going to talk more about this, man. I just get down the road and can't stop.
That's what these identities are supposed to do.
So let's just hear all about it from the man himself, general manager of the Winston-Salem Dash / hyphens, Brian DeAngelis.
We are now joined by Brian DeAngelis, the general manager of the Winston-Salem Dash, who have some exciting alternate identities coming up this season, beginning with the just-released Tobacco Beetles. Brian, thanks for taking the time out to talk to me.
That's right. Thanks, as always. Good to see you.
Yeah, and I see you there. As I began to introduce you, you put on the Tobacco Beetles hat. You've got this, he's driving a classic car. Looks very maybe 1920s. I know that's kind of a motif you guys have used in the past. Tell me about that and just the Tobacco Beetles in general.
Yeah, so, you know, Winston-Salem, no surprise, has a pretty deep history with agriculture, more specifically in the tobacco industry. And obviously kind of the peak time for that was the 1920s. And so this is a bit of an era-driven / industry-driven / the history of our entire town. Hyphen. But, you know, we wanted to tie those together. And, you know, one of the reasons we did tobacco beetle was most notably because it's a giant pest, not only in the fields when they're growing tobacco leaves, but also as they're curing and drying in the factories and warehouses. It was a really big problem that the people here had to address in order to, you know, sustain their economy, which is what was driving that at the time in the 20s. So we did a cute little throwback to it. And this Model T that he's driving, we actually purchased one as well that we're going to be shuttling fans to and from during the game. And so we're going to have some fun with it. We're excited for it.
Yeah, a tobacco beetle, as you said, you know, is a pest. And I'm sure there were eras of Winston-Salem history and a lot of other regions that grew tobacco and other crops where these things were looked at as, you know, public enemy number one. The tobacco beetle looks like a bit like a gangster who would be public enemy number one. I guess enough time has passed. You know, it's not, people aren't going to say too soon in terms of, you know, celebrating this, but, you know, what was your approach to this, knowing that it is a pest? You know, you're celebrating something that was a major problem.
Yeah. And I think that one of the things we're championing is the fact that we were able to handle and manage that pest and not let it impact, because it's something that, you know, in actuality could have destroyed entire crops. And for any agricultural town would know that that's kind of the end of your economy if that were to happen. So really it was one of the advances that we had in agriculture, that we were able to find solutions and find ways around that and to be able to go out into the fields and, you know, take care of this problem that we had. And for us, it's more of a callback to that era. And we have such a rich history of baseball. We played even before the 20s in Winston-Salem and really ever since then. So we wanted to do that and kind of bring this little guy to life. And, you know, I think it's just something that people in town here, and especially throughout North Carolina, there's several towns that are much like Winston-Salem, even towards Durham, that had similar issues. So it's really our tribute to the entire state of North Carolina and the citizens of those that, you know, were part of this industry in one way or another.
Yeah. And when I saw this identity, you know, I'm always racking my brain, having done this for as long as I have, of things that might be similar or possible inspirations. And I did think of the boll weevils, the Piedmont boll weevils, you know, who became the Cannapolis Intimidators, and now they're the Cannonballers. But, you know, that was kind of a similar identity, as celebrating a bug that was a pest that yet everybody knew. Did you take inspiration from that or anything else, or was this an idea that kind of came about independently?
Yeah, it's funny because I think, how can I have an idea that's independent when, you know, you've been covering this for so long? I've been in this thing for a little while now, and it's like, well, technically a grasshopper is also a pest in some agricultural areas, and they're right next door in Greensboro. You used to have the sand gnats, right, down in Savannah before. And so, yeah, there's all these different ones that really have been a pesty bug. And, you know, this is just another one of those that was a little more specific to, you know, our town and our history and heritage. So, yeah, to say there was a completely independent and original idea probably isn't true. But, you know, for us, the way we wanted to approach this, as we kicked around some, like, what is this town really known for? And this is one of those things that's the best way to kind of bring that to life with being a pest. And we haven't done that. We haven't really had a bad guy image at all in any of our past history. So I think this will be our first, and we'll see how people respond to it.
Yeah, and we talked about, you know, how this tobacco beetle looks and driving the Model T car and, you know, referencing an era of 100 years ago and more. How did you go about creating that identity, and, you know, who did you work with to bring this to life?
Yeah, so we worked with Brandios on this one. So Jason and the guys, as we talked through, you know, what this town meant and some things that are important to people here, you know, just kept coming back to that era. And so we've done a few things in that era, but this was certainly one of them. And it definitely coincided because there was there's a rich history, as you know, in North Carolina of NASCAR. And so as we started to look at what were the 20s like, and, you know, those stock cars that they were using to, you know, bootleg and things like that. We almost started with a bootlegger because we have Bowman Gray is right in our backyard as well, which is a NASCAR short track, and it's one of the longest running stock car venues in the country. And so we started down that path, and obviously with the Intimidators and the, some of those things have been done already. And we said, well, there's probably a marriage between those two things, between, hey, this was the industry in the 20s is what we're known for. And also we have this NASCAR thing. And so the car is where that's where that was born. And there's also some cultural history to that as well, where they actually started one of the first African-American owned bus lines and routes was done here right in Winston-Salem. And they took some of the cars similar to this one here and started running them as public transportation. And so we kind of started like, okay, well, now we have a little history here, there. Can we connect all these things? And that's really where this image was born.
Yeah. Now, you know, before we started recording, you were saying how, well, this is a one of our more, you know, regionally specific alternate identities. But to me, like the kind of stuff you're talking about is why it's interesting, because it'll resonate with the community, but also just for people who follow minor league baseball at large, you learn things. I've learned a lot more about the country because of these things. So as goofy as they are, there's always a story behind them. And that seems like an approach that your team has been taking, the Dash have been taking a lot more in recent years. I know you had finally did that hyphens alternate identity, kind of riffing on how you're the Winston-Salem Dash, but it's technically a hyphen. You did the flights identity, referencing, you know, aviation and beer at the same time. I know, you know, speaking of beer and concessions, you know, a lot more, you know, creative approach to concession items. You know, those weren't always things that I associated with the Dash promotionally through the years. So can you kind of speak more about this organizational shift and the approach you're taking now?
Yeah, that's a pretty fair point. It wasn't really the business as usual for the Dash to do those types of things, but that's something that I've always enjoyed about the industry, and one of the reasons that I'm in it. I mean, we could go work anywhere, right? But there's some connection that we have to this thing we're doing. And I think one of those is to be able to be creative and be able to tell a story and to be able to add to your community in those ways. And so, yeah, sometimes it's via food because not everybody understands the tobacco beetles, or not everyone understands, or is, you know, is a linguist, I guess, and cares about if it's a hyphen or a dash. But you can do things that's for everybody. And so as we've done the flights and the shag and the hyphens and now tobacco beetles, we're just trying to take the fresh approach that, hey, the Dash are doing this now. And did you see that thing that they did, right? That's kind of what minor league baseball is and does. And it's taken us this past 2 years to kind of get there and start to get the town and maybe the industry a little bit to take note of some of those things we're doing. And we have two more that are unreleased at this point that we're going to be doing for this season. And actually two more beyond that we've already planned for next season. So we're going to keep them coming. And as long as people respond well to them and enjoy them and keep coming to games, I see no reason to stop.
Yeah, and also when we were talking before I started recording, you know, it just a fluke how it worked out with me. But of every minor league ballpark I visited, and I visited every active ballpark, it's been the longest period of time since I've been to Winston-Salem. So I'm very much hoping to get back there this year. It's one of the major items on my agenda. So to me, but not necessarily to me, because I plan on coming again. But for those not really familiar with the Dash and Winston-Salem in general, you know, what's your pitch to them in terms of why this is a place to come see a ball game and a city to visit?
Yeah. So what I like about it, and maybe because I'm a Pittsburgh guy, I like to have a small town, but a city. And that's kind of what I view Winston-Salem as, is the Southern version of that, where, you know, we have the town, we have the things you would get from the city life, but also we're small enough that you don't have to deal with any of the, you know, traffic or crime or any of that kind of stuff. And really our ballpark resembles that a lot because we're a downtown ballpark, meaning we're walkable, but we're not really in the city. So we have parking, we have plenty of ways to get there. And we actually have a pedestrian bridge running right across the highway, resembling the Clemente approach to PNC a little bit too. So it's really a ballpark that was built incredibly well, to their credit. I was not here when they did it, but I mean, you could easily plug a double or triple A team into this park, which is the sheer size and the amenities that it has to offer. But it still has that intimate feel in a lot of those areas that are very unique to the Dash, to Winston-Salem, still exist. And we're one of those, you know, clubs that I think is becoming more of a trend, but we moved our press box down on the concourse level. So upstairs, we have tons of room in our flow club, and we get pretty creative up there as well. You mentioned our food, but we actually have a hibachi grill up there that a chef is creating something custom every single game. And then, you know, we're hopeful that our in-game entertainment, whether there's a theme or not a theme going on, that we have some of the most unique experiences as well, because I like to go crazy when we do a theme. So when we have Princess Night, you better believe there's going to be a horse and carriage inside the stadium giving rides the entire time. We're blowing snow and turning some of the areas into Arendelle for the Frozen fans out there. So, I mean, we like to take an all-inclusive approach to our promo so that there's something for absolutely everybody that comes here. And it's just a great town, great place to raise a family. And then there's a lot to do as well.
Yeah, you mentioned being a Pittsburgh guy. I'm a Pittsburgh guy to an extent. I grew up in the Philly area, but went to the University of Pittsburgh. And, you know, one of my favorite places there was the O, the original hot dog and fries right in the heart of the Pitt campus. You know, hole in the wall, but greatly beloved. So to close out, in Winston-Salem, people are looking for a locally beloved establishment, you know, maybe a bit rundown, maybe not. But, you know, where do you direct them if they're looking to go up to a place with a lot of neighborhood character?
Oh, that's a great question. Our staff is probably more familiar with to answer that as from a bar scene. And I have a few, you know, that I would recommend for sure there. There is a chicken place, though, called Slappy's. And I will tell you, if you just walked in and you didn't get my description beforehand, you would probably walk back out. But it has the Winston neighborhood homie vibe. But the chicken that they make there has some kind of interesting sauce spice that's kind of baked in, and so when the chicken comes out, it almost is closer to black than like a golden brown, and so it looks like it might be burnt or just strange or whatever, but when you eat it, it's kind of like a spicy barbecue-y mixture that's like, until you have it, you can't really describe it very well with words. But that might be one of the places I would go, and it's next to, like, I don't know, a random mechanic shop and some building that's half torn down, and it just kind of sits right there and it's busy. I mean, every time you go in, you better get there early because it's extremely popular. But yeah, that'd probably be my staple here.
Well, there you have it. Visit Winston-Salem. See the Dash take the field as the Tobacco Beatles or the Dash themselves or any number of other alternate identities that could be coming soon. Visit Slappy's. Sounds like a good road trip to me. But yes, the Tobacco Beatles are out now, unveiled. Do you have the dates on the promo schedule for when they're taking the field?
Yeah, you do. I knew you were going to ask me that, and I knew I was going to get it wrong because I have all nine I'm balancing at one time now. But it is in August. It's later. We're releasing it very early, but it's a much later actual play date. So I'll send that over to you because I'm going to say the wrong one, and my promo people are going to get all mad at me. So I'll save myself the embarrassment.
All right. I know how that goes. So. Coming soon, or at least out now and coming later in the season, the Tobacco Beatles, and stay on the lookout for other things coming from the Winston-Salem Dash alternate identity universe. Brian DeAngelis, general manager of the Dash, thanks so much for speaking with me.
Thanks, Ben. Always good to see you.
Not quite as erotic, let's say, as the Dairy Daddies, but very good, very interesting. And very hyper local. I enjoy that about this Winston-Salem identity. The ability to eat through tobacco leaves seems very hearty. And you want to have a hearty baseball team. That's what I'm going to attribute this to. It's all heartiness.
I agree. It's very hearty. And speaking of eating, you know, in that interview, you know, I asked Brian DeAngelis about his you know, little local hole in the wall Winston-Salem recommendation. And he said, of course, for those who just listened to this, but Tyler hasn't yet, Slappy's Chicken. So Tyler is a former Carolina League. The Dash are now in the South Atlantic League, but back in the day, they were in the Carolina League. And you were a broadcaster, of course, from Myrtle Beach. Did you ever go to Slappy's Chicken? Or if not, did you have any Winston-Salem establishments that stuck out to you this many years later?
And now I'm really bummed that I did not make it to Slappy's Chicken. I do remember going to, is it Foothills Brewing in downtown Winston? There is a very good brewery in downtown Winston-Salem. And I do remember going there. But more than that, what I remember is this is a different time. This is a different era food-wise. There were very few places in the Carolina League map that had a Chipotle back then. It was like Winston, Frederick, and depending on the hotel we stayed at, Potomac, which of course is now Fredericksburg, which weirdly is the hat that I'm wearing today. But the Winston-Salem hotel that we stayed at was within walking distance of a Chipotle. And like 2010, that was money for me. That was where I consumed a lot of calories on the road of Winston-Salem. But now I'm a little bummed that I didn't go hyper local. That later on in my broadcasting career, that's the thing that I do now, is like I go to a place, I'm like, what is the local place that I need to try here? Back when I was 24 or 25, I did not do that nearly as often. I'm a little disappointed in myself.
There's still time to change.
Okay, good. Yeah.
Acknowledgement is an important first step.
Yeah.
Foothills Brew Pub is what it's called. Foothills Brew Pub. Very cool place. Very cool logo. Very good beers. They're not a sponsor of the show. But if they wanted to send us some swag and some beverages, we obviously wouldn't turn it down. Well, good stuff from Winston-Salem. And that helps us dovetail into yet another alternate identity, which is a new one from the Great Lakes Loons, and is a very Midwest feeling summertime thing. The Great Lakes Loons are going to go as the Great Lakes Pontooners for select games. Ben, give us the lowdown on the Pontooners. It's a very big boat in this logo. A pontoon boat, one might guess.
It is a pontoon boat, yeah. July 11th to 13th in Great Lakes, which is actually Midland, Michigan. Great Lakes Loons. They will be the Pontooners.
Midland, Texas, home of the Midland Rockhounds.
Yeah, exactly. There's the Midland Rockhounds in Texas, the Great Lake Loons in Midland, Michigan. The Loons, as their name would imply, Great Lakes, are near a Great Lake. You know, they are close to Saginaw Bay, which is part of Lake Huron. And there's a whole lot of other smaller bodies of water in the area. And it's a big thing in that area. Michigan, and I'm sure in Wisconsin and Minnesota too. The summers are short, the winters are long, so people really love to get out in the water while they can. And pontoon boats are a huge thing in that part of Michigan, and I'm sure other areas. You know, they're pleasure boats. They don't go very fast. They're built for having a good time just out on the water, you know, with your friends. So that's what they're trying to celebrate with the Pontooners identity. As you guys mentioned, it's a big old boat logo. The boat is of course anthropomorphic. You know, it's got a grin on its face, or a little bit of a scowl even. I don't know why. He's a pleasure boat. You think he'd look a little more pleasurable. There's a, you know, alternate logo or sleeve patch logo of a shirtless guy on a tube holding up a canned beverage of some kind, you know, having
not
a good time.
Not nearly the same physique as McCreamy, by the way.
No, not at all. He does not have the Dairy Daddy physique, but he's just having a good time. He's not here to be judged. And, yeah, and, you know, in talking to the team, I talked to Chris Worsley, their assistant general manager, and, you know, he was saying, and this is, you know, often the case, I think, for teams that play in largely cold weather regions, you know, they're in competition. I'm sure a lot of the front office staff themselves loves these activities, but with such a short window for summer and the height of the baseball season and really getting people out to the ballpark, one of the biggest competitions is people going out on the water. You know, I've heard that about various teams through the years, you know, in Appleton, Wisconsin, and Missoula, you know, they used to be the Osprey, now the Paddleheads. You know, it's tough, you know, when people just are really trying to maximize their summer to bring them to the ballpark. So this is kind of a, you know, if you can't beat them, join them type of thing of like, we're going to bring a, there's not going to be a lake at the ballpark, but they're going to have pontoon and party barge seating areas. 80s yacht rock dueling pianos, which, you know, sounds like a pretty good time. Beach towel koozie giveaways. So it's just kind of a salute to the larger region. And in the course of our interview, and this is an article that was featured in my newsletter on MILB.com/MLB.com. And this part wasn't in it, but I said, you know, I've only been to Great Lakes once, to Midland once. And the thing I remember is the Tridge. It's this bridge with like a two or three different points of entry that converge. And I'd never seen a Tridge before. And I said, you ever going to do a Tridge type of thing? And he said, probably not. Cause you know, that's Midland specifically, and we're Great Lakes Loons, and we want to, you know, Midland's a fairly small town. We want to do things that speak to the larger area and not just Midland itself. But if you ever do go see the Loons, take a walk on the Tridge, because what else are you going to get to hang out on a tridge. It's the only time I've been on a
tridge. I was going to say, the fact that it's called the tridge just makes me think, like, the fact that bridge starts with B isn't because it's a like a dual thing. It's not, there's no prefix with bridge. I don't know. I like it. It just, it's got me thinking. That's all.
No, I don't know where the name came from in that regard, but it works.
It works. It's the tridge. You know what it is based off the name. Yeah. That's the important.
And I remember Midland being a really beautiful town. I mean, it's the headquarters of Dow Chemical, which is what kind of made it a substantial town in the first place. And Dow still has a presence there. And they funded a lot of, you know, cultural stuff, and it made a nice place to live. I'm not so sure about Dow Chemical in general, but I need to do some research. But
I probably don't drink any pond water. Dudes, the pontooners will be out this summer for the Great Lakes Loons, and it does seem like a very fun, you know, afternoon thing to do on a Saturday in Midland, Michigan, or nearby. It's a place I've never gotten to explore. I haven't gotten to really go. I've been to Detroit, but I've not been elsewhere in Michigan. Michigan seems awesome, and I have not gotten a chance to explore.
Yeah, I only really did a full trip in Michigan once, like 2013, and I hope to get out there again soon, maybe even this season. But something that came up in writing this story in the course of my conversation with the team, it's just how beautiful the sunsets are, and that's what I remember. I remember it wouldn't get dark until past 9 o'clock, and the sunsets were spectacular. So while there is a brief window for summer, it is a gorgeous area to be in, you know, for those months of the year. So I would highly recommend getting up there. Sam's looking at a map of Michigan now. Midland is located in the kind of crook of the thumb of the Michigan glove. Yeah, with Lake Huron, Saginaw Bay, Lake Huron, just to the east.
It is pretty nice that they have a built-in map on the human body for Michigan. Unless you're from the UP, then you're kind of screwed. But you can read all about that, of course, MILB.com. You can subscribe to the Ben's Biz Beat there as well. And coming up, Sam and I are going to discuss some on-field spring training things as games have kicked off for 2024. Then Josh swings by with Ghost of the Miners, and we're back to wrap it up later on. All right, Sam, we've got spring training games already underway in the Cactus League and Grapefruit League. As an aside, I watched a Cactus League game yesterday, a Grapefruit League game yesterday, Atlanta versus Philadelphia on MLB Network. And in the middle of said game, they aired an infomercial starring Billy Mays, who's been dead since 2009. And I am desperate to know. I need to get in touch with somebody at MLB Network and be like, hey, how did this happen? But anyway, interesting game. Very, very fun game to watch. And it leads us into talking about some prospect things in the start of spring training across baseball. We're obviously a week away from the announcement of spring breakout rosters, but we are seeing some prospects getting into games across the spectrum. It appears we're going to see a Paul Skeens against Jackson Holliday matchup this week as those two teams square off, the Pittsburgh Pirates and the Baltimore Orioles in Grapefruit League in Florida. But Sam, what's catching your eye in these first few days of spring training games?
Yeah, I mean, that Paul Skeens-Jackson Holliday matchup is happening today as we record this. The Orioles and Pirates are playing, and that game features four of the most recent, or the five most recent number one picks. So it's Paul Skeens from last year, Jackson Holliday from 2022, Henry Davis from 2021, and then Adley Rutschman from 2019. All of those guys are in the starting lineup. You know, unfortunately, that's happening today and not, it's not something we can preview, so go check out that box score. We don't know how it ended up for anybody involved. But hearing from people I know in Florida right now, especially Jim Callis, who's covering the Grapefruit League for us, making the journeys through Florida, I will be joining that leg on Sunday myself. But it sounds like Paul Skeens is very excited about it. Jackson Holliday is very excited about it. And we could see those two actually face off on TV this time, because that game, unfortunately, is not televised. The Pirates and O's are matched up again for spring breakout. That is the Florida opener. So that game will be on TV on MLB Network. So hopefully both of those guys are in that game and facing off against each other again. And we can see kind of round two between those two guys. But in terms of like what stood out for me so far in this first week, I think the thing that's like popped most is that it's like kind of the spring of the big dudes. And I don't mean that just necessarily big names. I mean like literally big dudes. James Wood entering Thursday has been 5-for-11 with 2 homers and only 1 strikeout. He's walked 3 times so far for the Nationals. He's scheduled to start today's game on Thursday. So that means he's appeared in all 6 of the Nationals spring training games to this point. Davey Martinez, I know, loves the guy. One of the big things that's come out is people are starting to see his speed, which is something those of us who have covered James Wood for a few years now, dating back to his time in the San Diego Padres system, have always known that's in his bag. But he's 6'6", 6'7". Like, it's, he doesn't have to move very quickly to move. That's not the best way to put it, but he just has such long limbs that he eats up grass or dirt if he's running on the base paths. He just has such long strides that anybody I talk to about James Wood always says it doesn't look like he's trying hard. And yet he's getting to the first base bag quicker than almost anybody else on the field. I think he had a home to first time that StatCast measured at 4.07 seconds, which would at the time was the fastest home to first time in the Grapefruit League so far this season. He's playing in all sorts of ways. The big thing for me coming off last year at Harrisburg was his strikeout rate. You know, it seemed like he really struggled with softer stuff. He has such a big strike zone that pitchers have more opportunities to miss and still throw a strike. So he has to kind of reel in that approach a little bit. You know, if he keeps being around 30% at every level, that's fine. But like, it's tougher to project that strikeout rate from getting like to maybe the 40% level by the time he makes majors, given what it was last year at Double A. So that gives me a little bit of pause. But the fact that he's absolutely crushing the ball right now, limiting those Ks, everything's pointed in the right direction for James Wood. And at a time where the Nats need, you know, as much as good news as they can get, they are really pivoting towards, hey, this next generation is coming between James Wood, Dylan Cruz, who's also in Major League camp. Brady House has homered. Robert Hassel III homered to the opposite field the other day. Like, they have a lot of talent coming, and that's what they're kind of banking on for this next generation is those guys coming good. So James Wood certainly doing that. The other big guy I want to bring up real quick is Spencer Jones, number 84 overall prospect for MLB Pipeline's top 100 right now. He hit a 470-foot home run in the first week, which as it stands right now, and again, not every ballpark has StatCast data, so we're not – this isn't apples to apples. But as things stand right now, that 470-foot homer, as measured by StatCast, is the longest of spring training, and it's the longest by 21 feet. Nobody else is close. Now, Spencer Jones, another guy who's massive, a really big strike zone. There's some concerns about like his ability to cover that zone. But we've said this since the Yankees drafted him out of Vanderbilt. They know how to develop big guys. They have 2 of them. Now, Aaron Judge, they legit developed. And there were some questions about his strikeout rate as a prospect. He was never the number 1 overall prospect in baseball. And he's made it work, obviously, incredibly well. Spencer Jones is every bit the athlete that I think Aaron Judge is in terms of speed and defense. Is he going to be hitting 60-plus homers someday? I don't know about that yet. We'll have to see how that's going to kind of come around. He only just touched Double-A at the end of last year. But they're excited about him. And when he's hitting tanks like this, I mean, we knew the raw power is in there. But now it's clearly playing in games. One other guy I want to point out real quick who's not as big as those dudes, but this is a perfect example of like power comes in all packages. Tamar Johnson had a 2-homer game the other day for the Pittsburgh Pirates. He's had 8 plate appearances so far. He's got 2 homers and 1 double. Coming out of the draft a few years ago, a lot of people remember that many people thought he was the best pure hitting prospect to come in the draft in a long time, getting 70 hit grades. Then last year, it kind of flipped. He was more power over hit. The best thing about him offensively from a hit tool standpoint was that he took a ton of walks, was not expanding the zone, but he's got that lift and that swing, and it certainly has played already for Pittsburgh. I still have high hopes for Tamar Johnson. I know the shine's come off him a little bit. We have him ranked at number 44 overall, indicating that we still believe in him. But if he's hitting like this for power and his approach is going to be that good, I think the hit tool is going to come around. I think you're going to see him hitting 280, 290. And then all of a sudden, if he's adding like 30-plus homer power to that, that's really special, even if he's just sticking at second base. So a lot to be excited for on that Pirate side, but it's been kind of incredible. I don't know about what you've seen, Tyler, but just to see how prospects are playing this quickly, there haven't really been a lot of top dudes who have straight up struggled. I mean, maybe like Wyatt Langford isn't tearing the cover off the ball like we maybe expected. But overall, I mean, these guys are taking advantage of the opportunities given to them.
The thing that really excites me too is the amount of these guys who we could see in spring breakout games coming up over the next few weeks, because they're already getting into a good rhythm. It feels like here in the last week in February and then on into March, that's going to be really cool. And I think that that whole initiative is just such a great idea and a great concept. And for fans, if you're watching your team's top prospects and it looks like, oh, these dudes are ready to go, rather than, oh, right, it's the first or second week of spring training, that's a really exciting portion of this spring as well. So a lot of good stuff coming from the early returns from prospects here in 2024. And anything else that's caught your eye? Anything else that's standing out as far as themes that either in the early going or as we get deeper into spring training you're keeping tabs on?
Yeah, I mean, one that I'm definitely going to be following pretty closely is Jackson Merrill and his role in San Diego. Jackson Merrill is coming off a year last year. He split it between high A and double A, got off to a rough start with Fort Wayne. I think a lot of people thought he would actually open with double A San Antonio. That didn't happen. He opened at Fort Wayne, which like made sense. It's his second full season, but struggled there for a little bit, had to really turn it on late, then got to San Antonio. Doesn't strike out much. He never has. I think both K rates were below 12%. So he always does a good job meeting bat to ball, but you know, it wasn't quite as special a year as everybody thought about it for Jackson Merrill, but the Padres are always aggressive with their prospects, especially the ones they know are really good. We have Jackson Merrill down for a 65 grade hit tool. You can go up to 70 if you really believe in it. I think it's at least a 60. And they're like, hey, listen, you have an approach that's going to play everywhere. So the Padres haven't really been that aggressive. I mean, what's their biggest move of the offseason? It's trading away Juan Soto. You look at their outfield as it stands right now. Fernando Tatis Jr. is the only really guy who you're like, this is somebody who I definitely think is going to be in their opening day outfield. And the Padres approached Jackson Merrill. He got some time at second base last year. He got some time in left field, even like a little bit of first base. I'm not that worried about it. That just felt like a roster issue. But clearly, you know, they have Ha-Sung Kim, who's now their starting shortstop. They've slid over Xander Bogaerts, who they just gave a massive contract to. They're moving parts around, and they went to Jackson Merrill and said, hey, we want you to prepare to play even more outfield. And he seems to have really taken to that. He made a really nice catch in their opener the other day against the Dodgers. He said the other day, you know, gave some quotes from Padres camp that he actually feels more comfortable in center field just because I think the view is a little bit better out there. You have more room to roam. You can see the ball off the bat better. I don't know if he's going to play out there. He's not exactly like an absolute burner, but he's certainly athletic enough. And they just keep giving him chances. I mean, other organizations wouldn't do this with Jackson Merrill. Now, maybe another move is coming around the corner. You know, I said, I think Tatis is the only guy guaranteed to be in their opening day outfield, but they did re-sign Jurickson and Profar, who can play some left field. Jose Azucar is like right now their starting center fielder, maybe. But I think Jackson Merrill could certainly be in that conversation, especially if the hit tool keeps playing as we expect it will. And, you know, the Padres, this is the team that pushed Ethan Salas to double A at 17 last year. This is a team that pushed Fernando Tatis Jr. really aggressively when he was young. They have Jackson Merrill in that conversation in terms of special prospect. So we'll see how things go. But like, unless another move is coming, it seems like we're trending towards Jackson Merrill opening day major leaguer. We'll see how things go in the weeks to come.
So, of course, you can keep tabs on where all your prospects are and everything else at MLB Pipeline. And coming up, Josh Jackson stops by with Ghost of the Miners, and then we're back to wrap things up on the other side.
Interrupt this podcast to bring you another thrilling edition of Ghosts of the Miners. Now, here's your correspondent and host, Joshua Jackson.
Welcome back to Ghosts of the Miners, in which all of you out there in Radio Land must identify the legitimate historical ball club or player hiding amidst the fraudulent pair. One didn't perform very well on the ball field, but the others didn't ever perform anywhere at all. In the last segment, I asked you which of the following minor league baseball teams did at one time exist. A. The Hemingway Cubs. B. The Fitzgerald A's. C. The Joyceville Pirates. You're a well-read fan if you picked B. The Fitzgerald A's, who played in the Georgia-Florida League of 1956, operating in the seat of, believe it or not, Ben Hill County in Georgia. The team took on the name of its new parent club that year, having previously existed in various iterations as the Pioneers and, during the 1954 season when they had an affiliation with Cincinnati, as the Redlegs. But in 56, Fitzgerald began a jazzy age with the Kansas City partnership, and so, showing an agility of moniker, became the Athletics. Considering the American League's A's were 52 and 102 that season, it should come as no surprise that the Georgia-Florida League's A's did not ace it either. Managed by Wilson Tobbs legend Red Treadway, that year Fitzgerald played like a lost generation, making the league into a story of the beautiful and the damned, with our A's nowhere to be found this side of paradise. However, tender was the night of June 2nd, when Fitzgerald hurler Hank Zostak tossed a perfect game in a 7-inning tilt against the Brunswick Pirates, spanning 9 in a twin bill opener that was over in an hour and a quarter. But even those Bucks bettered our A's in the end, with Brunswick finishing 62-76, and the A's way down in Z, dead last with a 47-92 record. Fitzgerald continued to compete in the Georgia-Florida League in 1957, but with a new parent club and a new name. Under the wing of the Baltimore Orioles, the Fitzgerald Orioles were helmed by a budding player-manager by the name of Earl Weaver. And that's how the boats beat against the current for the Fitzgerald A's. Now, on to the question for next time. Which of these players took the field in a galaxy close, close to home in the minors of yesteryear? A. Han Solar. B. Prince Leiter. C. Elmer Yoder. Want to know the answer? Use the Force, or tune into the next Ghost of the Miners. But for now, you'll have to excuse me. My producer Ben Hill is at the seat of his county, and the voters are taking a stand.
Big thanks to Josh Jackson for stopping by with Ghosts of the Miners today. I didn't get that one. I didn't guess it correctly.
Yeah, I like the Ben Hill reference though. That team was playing in.
There's multiple Ben Hill references.
Ben Hill County.
Yeah, multiple.
Ben Hill County.
Yeah, they're playing in Ben Hill County. My grandmother, sorry, on my dad's side, lived in the Atlanta area for a lot of years when I was a kid, and would occasionally take pictures of signs for like the Ben Hill exit, and I thought that was really cool. But all these years later, I've never been to Ben Hill. And then recently, it was just a couple weeks ago, an intern for the Spearfish Sasquatch, if we're really going down a summer collegiate rabbit hole today, was announced by the team, and his name is Ben Hill. So I almost want to do an interview with him on the show, just like 5 minutes, just be like, hey, you're Ben Hill in baseball. Tell me about yourself.
Yeah. Or you have to fight him for Ben Hill supremacy.
Fight for supremacy.
One Ben Hill.
Yeah, that's true. But I choose to be inclusive. I didn't want to make it a fight.
Either way, we should record it for the show. I mean, the ratings would just be through the roof.
That is true. That is definitely true. That the only thing that'll surpass that is when we get Bruce Springsteen on coming up soon, which is going to be very exciting.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Right.
Talking about the Lakewood Bruce Claws or Jersey Shore Bruce Claws.
I'm just going to wrap every episode from now on saying next week on the show, before the show, Bruce Springsteen swings by. That's going to be it. All right. Before we go, we've got another quiz from the quizmaster himself, Ben Hill. It is not about February 29th birthdays, but happy birthday, Terrence Long. Ben, what do you got?
Yeah. You know, last week, tried to make you guys guess who turned out to be Steve Balboni, and by giving clues about his career. Today, we have a pitcher. Don't start guessing yet, but it's a pitcher. He played in parts, you know, all or part of 18 major league seasons, all or part of 13 minor league seasons, 102 and 115 in major league, 61 and 48
in the minors for a total record of 163 and a 160. Wait, yeah, 100. He was like pretty much dead even in his total professional tally, 168 and 167. So played a really long time. He popped into my mind because I like the veterans who, you know, just hold on and try to find a way to come back. And his last appearance in affiliated ball was for the Buffalo Bisons in 2013 when they were a Blue Jays affiliate. And he was 42 years old, and he never did get back up to the majors, but that's how his career ended. Wow. It began as a member of the Expos organization way back in 1990 when he played for Rockford in 90 and 91, West Palm Beach in the Florida State League in 92. But then when he made his major league debut, just for one game in 92, it was with the Pirates. Then he spent a lot of time in the Pirates organization with Harrisburg back in Double A. Then the Marlins organization with Charlotte. Then back in the majors in 96 with the Marlins, 97 with the Cubs, 98 back with the team that signed him, the Montreal Expos. Still has not really gained a football foothold at this point, even though now he's in his later 20s. Really got going as an established major league pitcher after spending a little time in the Kansas City organization, pitched for Omaha, and played for the Royals a little bit, then back to Montreal again, but then Arizona in 2001.
Arizona in 2001. So he was on a staff with Randy Johnson and Curt Schilling that won the World Series.
He was, and he was the kind of guy who was sometimes a starter, sometimes a reliever, pretty even split through his career between like being a reliever, being a starter. But did play for the Diamondbacks 2001, 2003, Toronto 2004, 2005, back to Arizona in 2006, Seattle, linking up with Jamie Moyer in 2007, 2008, and 2009, the Washington Nationals in 2010, then back to Buffalo for the first time in 2011 when they were a Mets affiliate, played a little for the Mets, a little for the Cardinals at age 40.
Can I just say the name that like is coming to mind for me? And I don't know if this matches up with all this, but I'm just going to say it anyway.
Because I have no guesses.
Steve Traxel?
Incorrect.
I don't know why Steve Traxel just kept coming to my brain. But
I was blanking on this guy's name when he popped into my mind at first, and I Googled pitcher poet. He had a reputation as a literary guy, and he was a published poet.
John Lieber?
He's from the Dominican Republic.
Interesting.
From the Dominican Republic. Why John Lieber can't grind either.
It's really sad how few Expos I can think of now. Like Expos pitcher, it wasn't Randy Johnson or Pedro Martinez. No idea.
Wasn't LeVon Hernandez.
No, not Cuban.
The guy who really bounced around and just found a way to last into his 40s.
Man.
All the way to 2013. What's something else I can give you guys? Here.
This is a tough one.
Yeah.
16 and 11 for the 2007 Mariners. It was probably his like most impressive season with just simple stat wise. Again, a lot of bullpen, a lot of starting. Got that championship ring with the 2001 Diamondbacks.
I have a dude who is in my head. I can see his face and I cannot think of his name.
He has the same first name as a surefire Hall of Famer who retired at the end of 2023.
Miguel.
Correct.
Batista.
Correct.
Yes, that's who I was thinking of. It really is. Miguel Batista, because he was in the booth with us last year at the World – well, 2 years ago now, the World Baseball Classic qualifiers in Germany. He's doing some work with the commissioner's office these days. I had Miguel Batista's head in my brain. It's like, I've seen this face. I know this face. I know who this dude is. And I forgot about the writing thing because that was something that we talked to him about. Yeah, he's a published author. And I want to say maybe, does he also write music possibly or play music? Maybe. Anyway, Miguel Batista, yeah.
That's a fun one. Yeah, because he had such a journeyman career.
A 20-year big league career. He also, according to his Wikipedia, so you know it's correct, he also published a thriller novel called Through the Eyes of the Law, which was released in 2006. And wow, Miguel Batista. He is he's 53 now. But he was pitching like just over a decade ago. That's pretty dang cool.
Yeah, I'm always fascinated by guys who end their long careers in the minors. You know, nothing rehab related, but just don't hang it up until they absolutely have nowhere else to go. You know, we talked about Dave Kingman, you know, did that last week. Of course, I love the Jamie Moyer example, who after getting released by the Rockies in 2012, signed with the Orioles and pitched for Norfolk. Then asked for his release because he didn't see a shot there in Baltimore, and then pitched for Las Vegas 51s, who were then with the Blue Jays. And that's how Jamie Moore's career ended, in the Pacific Coast League in 2012 at age 49.
Just imagine signing up to like pitch in Vegas.
Yeah, at age 49.
I mean, you're playing for that team because you hope you're getting a chance with the Jays, but like, oh man, signing yourself to pitching that stadium back then.
Not like current, highfalutin Vegas. This was Cashman Field Vegas. This was we can't play games in certain weather conditions because people will burn to death on the bleachers, Vegas.
Yeah, and if you have a home ERA below 6.5, we're going to call that a win.
Yeah, I mean, and that's how it ended. Yeah, that was, sewage leakage issues in the dugout, Cashman Field. But, you know, when you just say, like, I'm going to go, as long as a team signs me, let's do it.
I have total respect for anybody who pitches into their 40s, knowing how difficult that is.
Yeah.
The wear and tear that, like, to be that durable, to last that long, to keep getting jobs. Congrats to this is very belated on Miguel Batista's career, but congrats to Miguel Batista.
Yeah, Sam's finally realizing, like, wow, this guy deserves my respect. Yeah,
I mean, he can have my respect. He made the major leagues as a pitcher. Like, all those guys have my respect. Yeah,
I've been withholding it for so long.
I've never said it out loud. Here I am today. Congrats. I've never
adequately expressed my appreciation for Miguel Batista's longevity in his career. That was pretty cool. You have surpassed me and Sam if you got Miguel Batista more quickly than we did, which I'm sure somebody out there tuned in did, but that was
out there certainly did. And if you have any suggestions, don't email the podcast because these guys can't see it, but email me benjamin.hill@mlb.com. looking for veteran players who spent a lot of time in both the major and minor leagues, extra points if they ended their career in the minor leagues, looking for that one last shot.
I like it. Well, that'll do it on this week's episode of the show. Before the show, huge thanks to Mick Creamy and everyone else. Coming up next week, Bruce Springsteen stops by the show before the show. Very exciting times. And for Sam Dykstra, Benjamin Hill, Josh Jackson, anthropomorphic cows with six packs, and all the rest, my name is Tyler Mon. We'll catch you next week.